Cold mornings, frosty windows. Yep, it's that time of year. So treat yourself and start your day with a cup of fresh roasted Sterling Roastery coffee, sourced from around the world and roasted multiple times a week for unbeatable freshness. It's the kind of warm-up every sports fan deserves this holiday season. And right now, you can win one of three $50 Sterling gift cards, perfect for gifting or building your own winning lineup of Java in the morning. Enter today at sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways so you can wake up, warm up, and Sterling up this holiday season. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways.
125 defining moments, one legendary league. This is Darren Hayes of the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, and a great book is out right now, NFL Moments, 125 Icons and Stories That Define the NFL. It's a definitive visual history of the National Football League, packed with iconic images and untold stories behind the game's biggest plays and its greatest players. From the early legends like Red Grange to today's stars like Patrick Mahomes, this book is a touchdown for fans who crave more than just stories. So give your football bookshelf a Hall of Fame upgrade or snag a holiday gift for that NFL history buff on your shopping list. Pick up NFL Moments, available now at your favorite bookseller. Football wasn't always the way it looks like today. We're spoiled by the modern television and watching live football. But once upon a time, football had a much larger ball to play with. Timothy Brown of Football Archaeology joins us to tell us all about this tale of when football had bigger balls. He's up in just a moment to let us all know all about it.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com. Welcome once again to the Pigpen, your portal to positive football history. And welcome to another Tuesday where we get to go to footballarchaeology.com's expert, Tim Brown. Tim, welcome back to the Pigpen.
Hey, Darren. This is finally I have the chance to talk to you about big balls.
And not the AC/DC song from the 70s, but...
I'm not even familiar with that.
No, okay. Well, you gotta look it up sometime. It's quite entertaining.
I wasn't like an AC/DC guy. I was more of a jazz,
Oh, okay.
Smooth
okay.
Kind of fella.
Maybe they have a jazz version of it. Yeah. Who knows? I doubt it, but it's rather raunchy. But anyway, you had a recent tidbit titled "When Football Had Bigger Balls," and we would love to hear about this history of the ball. Yeah. I'm assuming.
Yeah. Yeah, so it is about big balls. Okay, let's move on from the little double entendre. The reality is that football comes from rugby, and in the early days, so when football first was played in America, or rugby was first played in America and then became football, standard match ball from English rugby had a 30-inch circumference. And just to kind of compare that, you think about lugging a ball around or trying to throw a ball with a 30-inch circumference. A basketball, the standard basketball today, like the NBA and colleges use, has a circumference that is
30 inches.
29.5 inches.
Oh, okay.
The point is that
football had a bigger girth than a basketball.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Well, basketball wasn't invented at the time. So, at that point, basketball didn't come around until late 1890s, I think. But anyways, but that is a large ball to be toting around in your arm. And so, but part of that was, rugby and soccer were the same game for a long time, right? I mean, there were different variations, different mixes. With rugby, they wanted kind of an ovoid ball because that had more lift, and so they could kick it over the goalpost, whereas rugby was to kick it under the goalpost. And that was kind of the whole game. But rugby was still very much a kicking game, not a carrying game, at the time that Americans started playing it. And but American, you know, you could run with it, but most of the game was kicking. And so, but as Americans preferred the running aspect of rugby, they changed the rules, changed the game. And eventually they said, you know, probably be easier to carry this thing if it's smaller. So back then, all inflated balls, whether it was an association or soccer ball or rugby ball, or what they called an American ball at the time, which was kind of a canvas rubberized ball, they all came in. They started at a number 6, which was 30 inches in circumference. The number 5 was 27 inches. The number 4 was 24 inches, blah, blah, blah. And so they came in different sizes, three inch increments. And so eventually they, in American football, they started using a 27 inch ball. And then, you know, and because it was easier to carry. And so, you know, and then like in 1902, Spalding, which was a dominant supplier right here, they were a dominant supplier at the time. They introduced a new ball, not this one, but, you know, maybe a year or two later. They introduced a new ball that was yet smaller again. You know, so it was like a 24 plus inch ball. And so anyway, you know, we progressively got a smaller and smaller ball. And so now, you know, I cover like, I'm saying this as a little bit of his plug for my books, but I'm more just saying, like, if you're interested in this stuff in more detail, I cover the history of the football in my last book called The History of the Football. Right? I mean, it covers the whole history from, you know, back to rugby days through to more or less current times, and, you know, all the changes to the ball and why they changed. And then my most recent book, When Football Came to Pass, covers a forward pass. And that really drove changes in the size of the ball. So there were changes to make the ball easier to carry. And then the next real kind of evolution came to make the ball easier to pass, right? I mean, if you think about major eras or epochs. And so, you know, it's a funny thing, like early passers, like when they first introduced the forward pass, people had no idea how to throw the ball. You know, I mean, there wasn't an instruction manual. You know, it's like, you can throw a forward pass, but no one told you how to do it. So, you know, the newest book details kind of the techniques they used, and, you know, some of them are just bizarre. But who knew? You know, I mean, no one knew how to do it. So, and part of the challenge was, the ball was big. It was this, you know, even the smaller ball was this fat, kind of rotund ball, very thick in the middle. And so unless you had very large hands, it's very difficult to throw the ball in the way we now throw it, the overhand spiral. So they used all kinds of different techniques. And so one of the great myths of football is that, you know, you can read in a lot of places, people say, well, they made the ball smaller in 1912 because of the forward pass. And that is just 100% wrong. That did not happen. Spalding unilaterally reduced the size of the ball in 1903. But, and that was the size of the size of the ball they made in 1903 was made official in the rule books in 1912, but they didn't change it from what Spalding had done in 1903. All they did was like codify it. They made it official. And so like Eddie Kokoms, who was the father of the forward pass, St. Louis U coach, blah, blah, blah. The first team that really threw the forward pass effectively using the overhand spiral. At the end of 1906 season, he was calling for making a smaller ball, you know, slimmer. Now, he kind of called for this airship design, so he would have made it longer and narrower. And he repeated it multiple times, but then nobody did anything about it. until it wasn't until 1929, and then they made another change in 1903. But that two-step change is when the ball essentially became today's size. You know, they, you know, teams were using what they call bootleg footballs to, you know, just they were basically using illegal balls in the games, mostly guys like in Texas and in the South who were more passing oriented. And eventually the, you know, the coaches convinced the rulemakers, hey, we want a smaller, narrower ball, so it's easier to throw. And it's just all about encouraging the forward pass, which by then was finally really accepted, enough that they changed the ball to support, you know, enhancing, you know, the ability to throw the forward pass. Before that, it was like, oh, screw you guys, you know? So anyways, I mean, it's just one of those things, like, you just, you can't imagine how big the balls used to be, you know? I mean, again, if you think about it as a basketball, that was the original size, and then it got, you know, progressively smaller until we reached, you know, essentially, you know, the 1934 ball that was approved for the NCAA, the NFL approved that same size ball for 1934, and they've never changed it. You know, the NFL ball, or 1935, the NFL size of 1935 is the same ball they've used today. NCAA made a tweak in like 82 that didn't really do much. And, you know, and like Canada claim, you know, they, and the CFL has shirts like, you know, we have bigger balls. Well, yeah, I mean, it had little bit, proportions were a little bit different, but their balls have been the same size as the U.S. balls since, you know, more or less since they started using a forward pass in like 29 and a little bit later. So anyways, that's the story of bigger balls. And if you need to cut that out, just, you know, feel a bleep, you know, bleep me or whatever you need to do. But that's the story. Yeah.
No, I mean, it's fascinating. And I mean, I can't even imagine a 30-inch ball. I know probably 4 or 5 years ago, I was at a convention at the Pro Football Hall of Fame, and they had some balls that were the same. They're replicas made modern by modern leather maker that be the same size as what they used in 1920 when the NFL started as the APFA. And yeah, so we were in this big sort of conference room. So a few of us said, you know, they even invite us, hey, try to throw a spiral with these things. And we're grabbing on this thing. It's like basically falling out of your hand and, you know, not very accurate. And I'm like, okay, yeah, this is a challenge for 1920. Yeah. And they were much smaller than 30 inches. I'm sure they were probably more the 24, 22 inch size but they were hard to handle. So I don't even know how you would do that other than basketball passes. And that's probably part of the dilemma that they had when they were starting to think about
that. Well, and it's not just, so, you know, besides the size, you know, the lacing was like more or less like the rawhide lacing that you use on a baseball glove, you know, so it wasn't stiff like the polyvinyl chloride, the white laces today are plastic, you know? And then like the pebbling and the grip, you know, they've changed the tanning process. There's been innovations to make all of that better. So even a wet ball is better. Plus they use the same ball the whole game back then, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, until, I don't know, somewhere in the 30s or 40s, they finally said, okay, you can substitute a ball here and then. So if you were playing on a muddy, wet field, sorry, buddy, you know, that's the ball. And there was no towels. There's no wiping it off. You just played with the ball, whatever was on it. You know, so, I mean, just if you ever, you know, besides all the pass blocking problems and things like that, you ever wonder why passing, you know, like a 45% passer was considered pretty darn good at the time? Well, guess what? That was a big ball, and it was hard to throw, and it was slippery. And, you know, I mean, just so many things come into play there.
It probably looked much like the modern Cincinnati Bengals offensive line. Now they only have 2 seconds to throw, but that's a different story for a different day. Yeah. But Tim, you have some fascinating things in here. You know, you have your books out, you know, book on the football, book on the pass that really, like you said, gets into these ball size changes. And but you have many other aspects of the game that make it very interesting to us modern fans how we got to the point where we're at. And you do this a lot on your site and your tidbits. Maybe you could share with folks where they can find them.
Yep, just go to footballarchaeology.com. It's a Substack site. So subscribe. You'll get an email every time I send, publish a new one. And otherwise, just hit the site whenever you want. Or, you can find, you can follow me on Blue Sky too, if that suits your fancy. Because every time I publish, I put it out there in Blue Sky. So whatever floats your boat.
All right. Well, great stuff as usual. We really appreciate you coming on here and sharing this. And we would love to talk to you again next week.
Very good. Look forward to it, Darren.
That's all the football history we have today, folks. Join us back tomorrow for more of your football history. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
You did not see their faces on the Wheaties boxes, nor did they have the headlines, but they were breaking barriers, one pitch at a time. The integration of minor league baseball, a history and player register, 1946 to 1959, by Rick Swain and Gary C. Fink, shines a light on the overlooked heroes who paved the way for future legends. From dusty bus rides to hostile crowds, these players fought for a place in a game that did not want to see them win. More than history, it's a tribute to courage, perseverance, and the power of a game to change. Honor their legacy today and grab a copy of The Integration of Minor League Baseball at your favorite bookseller.